For that generous introduction, and also, of course, for inviting me, and thanks also to Claire for all her help with the technical side. I'm going to speak for about 55 minutes. That's the bad news. I will, however, try to keep you as engaged as I possibly can. So, here we go. Scene. Interior of the palace of Agamemnon at Mycenae. Big outer door in front. To right and left are doors leading to inner chambers. The room is simply furnished with jars of oil, wine, etc., and a hip bath. An axe hangs on the wall. In the corner of the room stands an expensive roll of carpet. In the middle is the Ekklesiarch, a small truck on a line of rails which run through the big front doorway. Clytemnestra is discovered with a recipe book, making a libation. On the roof, the watchman is delivering his opening speech. He cannot, of course, be seen, but when he performs his dance, the palace rocks violently. Enter watchman. The Cambridge Greek play of 1900 was the Agamemnon of Aeschylus, performed as usual in the darkening days of Michaelmas term. On the last day of the production, the 21st of November, there appeared the second issue of a new King's College magazine, Basileona. One of the contributors was a rather mousy young man, not yet 22, who had taken an upper second in part one of the Classics Tripos that summer, and had decided to stay on for a further year to read history. Having already published two miniature sketches in the first issue, including one which makes an addition from Cambridge life to the corpus of Theophrastus' characters, written in the style of Jeb, he now turned his attention to the Greek stage in a short dramatic spoof entitled A Tragic Interior, being an attempt to interpret the inner meaning of the Agamemnon of Aeschylus. E.M. Forster is not best remembered as a classicist, and yet, as with so many others of his time, classics played a central part in his intellectual formation and has left many traces, both more and less overt, in his fiction. At Tunbridge School, he enjoyed, in the words of his biographer, a weekly diet of 19 hours of classics, with not all that much else besides. Unperturbed, Forster proceeded in 1897 to King's, where his main influences were to be Goldsworthy Lowes Dickinson, classicist, philosopher, and political scientist, and the now little-remembered Nathaniel Wedd, whom Forster was later to describe as cynical, aggressive, Mephistophelian, wore a red tie, blasphemed, and taught Dickinson how to swear too, always a desirable accomplishment for a high-minded young don. 2 years earlier, Wedd had published an edition with commentary of Euripides' Orestes, reflecting a widespread contemporary Cambridge interest in Greek tragedy, led, of course, by Richard Jebb, Regius Professor and author of the great Sophocles commentary, with others in his slipstream, including Arthur Verrill, who had published a commentary on the Agamemnon in 1889, and Walter Headlam, who had written a book of 162 pages attacking it. The Cambridge production of 1900 may have lent itself to parody. Pat Easterling cites the review by Max Beerbohm, not a man to mince words. I do hope that Cambridge feels heartily ashamed of its stupid, tawdry perversion of the Agamemnon. Beerbohm might well have enjoyed Forster's own perversion of it. In A Tragic Interior, the young writer recreates the Agamemnon as a Victorian drawing room comedy, with elements of farce and much breaking of the dramatic illusion. The traces of 19th century burlesque, classical burlesque, are evident. The action of the play is assumed to be taking place outside in the theatrical space. What we see in Forster's script is what is happening simultaneously inside the palace. So the watchman, following his speech, which forms the prologos, enters the palace and announces, queen. Troy is taken and Agamemnon returns. Very well. Go to the inner store cupboard and bring back a clot of the best oil. Don't lose the key. Hadn't I better take the bath away? Leave the bath where it is. The action that follows is naturally speeded up. Think Stoppard's 15-minute Hamlet. And focuses on Agamemnon's arrival, the Cassandra scene, and, of course, the murder. Surprises, too, are in store. We meet not only Electra, carrying a wooden doll, but Chrysothemis, carrying a wax one, no doubt angry with Aeschylus for not giving her a part. Great play is made with a carpet unrolled on cue out of the palace door by the servants on Clytemnestra's orders, despite the misgivings of one of them that Master won't half like the best carpet undone. And indeed he's right, for when the victor of Troy enters his palace, his first words are, "It's not the impiety I object to, but the extravagance. Think of the carpet. It'll never be the same again, even though I did take off my shoes. The bloom's off it forever. Of course, dear, you've meant it kindly, but you might have known me better. And Apollo save us, why have you put the bath on the Echiclema?" Obsessing about the carpet and resistant to Clytemnestra's urging him to take a bath, the king discovers what is afoot. "Now, Clytemnestra, I've given in to you about the carpet, and the result is it's spoilt. I will not give in about the bath. Servants, retire. What are you going to do, pray?" "Kill you. In the bath. With the axe." "What? The chorus have been foretelling it for years. There'll be a revolution if it doesn't happen. You know that." The final dissolution of the plot into complete absurdity follows the entry into the palace of Cassandra, who, seeing that time is of the essence, tells Agamemnon, "You must pretend you are dead, or else there will be a revolution." He utters his death cries, the two of them climb onto the Echiclema and are echiclaimed out with Clytemnestra and the axe. The play ends, the Echiclema returns inside, and Agamemnon sits up. "What an experience, far more confined than the wooden horse, and all my clothes wet, and the axe has scratched the paint off the bath." But that's the least of his worries. "Pray," says Clytemnestra, "how are we to keep up appearances before the servants when you are both supposed to be dead? Aegisthus," yes, he's there too, "provides the answer. They must pretend to be ghosts, of course, I mean, flit about noiselessly and all that. And pray, how are we to get through the coeiphory?" "Well, for my part, I didn't see why we should have it at all." Not to be put off by his own creation, Forster, 3 months later, writes the sequel, A Tragic Interior 2. For the moment, however, he brings his current tragedy to an end thus. "Really now, this play might have been written by Euripides. Or by Dr. Verrill." Well, here, Forster raises a laugh at the expense of Arthur Verrill, whose eccentric interpretations of Greek tragedy were notorious. Headlam's Demolition Job attributed to him an overmastering cleverness that persuades him ever to prefer his own ingenious novelty to the truth which others have deduced. And if that refers to his textual criticism, it's hardly less applicable to his broader claims about tragic drama. But a further joke lurks in the turning of Agamemnon and Cassandra into disembodied spirits, picked up in the sequel. It opens with Electra sitting in the palace crocheting, with Agamemnon and Cassandra still alive, of course, habited as ghosts, nervously watching for an opportunity to retire. Verrill was thoroughly enmeshed in the parapsychology movement, represented by the Society for Psychical Research, where his position was that of a sceptic. Scully, not Mulder. It's partly in this context that the roots of his most famous work, Euripides the Rationalist, can be seen to lie. So the dialogue of the sequel begins with Electra musing to herself. They certainly look very solid. For my part, I don't believe in ghosts. Comedy, parody, Cambridge in jokes. And yet, more serious themes can also be discerned. Let's consider for a moment what's assumed in this bit of paratragedy. The reader has to understand that the audience is watching the Agamemnon itself in the theatre. When a character exits into the palace, the audience will imagine that the actor briefly relaxes, takes off his mask, notionally at any rate, and becomes himself, the actor, again. In Forster's scenario, the departing character does not switch off his or her characterness and revert to being an actor, but remains in character. The characters then turn out to be real, though at the same time, this reality is quite different from the exterior reality of the theatrical space. Inside the palace, they are, so to speak, themselves, aware that out there they are performing a play, putting on a mask, fulfilling prescribed roles. By definition, there will be seepage between these two realities, and indeed, as we've seen in the case of Electra and her ghostly father and his concubine, even within the interior reality itself, parts are played. Agamemnon and Cassandra are playing dead in an effort to keep Electra in the dark so that the coevery can proceed. Just so, Forster is himself playing in a complex way with the notions of interior and exterior, public and private worlds, appearance and reality, questions that will come to inform much of his life and work. Of the classical Greek tragedians, however, it was not Aeschylus who most engaged Forster's interest, but Sophocles. In a broadcast talk of 1944, he wrote of the Antigone that of all the great tragic utterances, that comes closest to my heart. That is my central faith. He provides little explanation, but light is shed by his famously provocative assertion in an essay of 1938 that if I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I hope I should have the guts to betray my country, a statement widely understood as a reflection of the central conflict of the play. And we might remember that the same year, Virginia Woolf in Three Guineas explicitly compared Creon with Hitler and Mussolini. The Oedipus at Colonus, too, has left explicit traces in his work, in Morris and the short story Other Kingdom, and most obviously in The Road from Colonus, first published in 1904, where an Englishman, Mr. Lucas, on his first visit to Greece late in his life, is denied the kind of splendid, heroising end accorded by Sophocles to the former Theban king, with whom he is expressly associated in the text. But my focus this afternoon will be on a different play, and I'm going to take as my starting point Forster's second novel, The Longest Journey, the only one of his novels not to have been popularised in the 1980s and 90s through adaptation for the cinema screen, and I would guess the least well known. But of all the novels, it is The Longest Journey which most overtly displays a debt to classical antiquity, with numerous references to classical literature and art. Like Forster himself, the novel's central character, Ricky Elliott, reads for the classics tripos at Cambridge, and subsequently, unlike Forster, enters the teaching profession, where he encounters Mr. Jackson, a sympathetic schoolmaster with an enthusiasm. And sooner or later, their talk gravitated towards Jackson's central passion, the fragments of Sophocles. Someday, he would edit them. At present, they were merely in his blood. With the zeal of a scholar and the imagination of a poet, he reconstructed lost dramas, Niobe, Phaedra, Philoctetes against Troy, whose names, but for an accident, would have thrilled the world. The passage is suggestive as underlining how little we know about the ancient world and how far it is a creation of our own imaginings, and contains, too, another Cambridge joke, indeed a double joke. Jackson is dreamily imagining himself in the role of Jeb, who was working on an edition of the fragments when he died in 1905. And Jeb's successor, as Regius Professor of Greek, elected the following year, was Henry Jackson. But this is not the first reference to Sophocles in the novel. On Ricky's very first day as a teacher, Jackson says to him, "You know, the Greeks aren't broad church clergymen. They really aren't, in spite of much conflicting evidence. Boys will regard Sophocles as a kind of enlightened bishop, and something tells me that they are wrong." Beyond these general references, however, The Longest Journey affords a very striking point of connection with a myth most famously dramatised by Sophocles. Ricky Elliott suffers from a hereditary physical defect, which is of some importance in the plot. He is lame. As Elizabeth Heiner has noted, the choice of this particular defect, rather than any other, invites us to link Ricky with Oedipus, whose own lameness is also, though of course in a rather different way, an indicator of his ancestry. Pursuing the connection, we might well go on to say that in both cases, the man marries a woman whom he should not. Indeed, this marriage is, in one sense, what The Longest Journey is about. Freudian interpretation is also readily available. Ricky hates his father and adores his mother. And given the very clear partial identifications between Ricky and Forster, it's not much of a leap to see Ricky's limp as a trope for the novelist's homosexuality, albeit that Forster himself, influenced by writers such as Edward Carpenter and Havelock Ellis, is likely at this period to have explained this not in Freudian, but in congenital terms. Following these cues, I'm going to argue that The Longest Journey and Forster's third and fourth novels, A Room with a View and Howards End, all published in a period of a little over 3 years, 1907 to 1910, possess a very specific tragic interior, presenting between them a set of interpretatively significant themes that are paradigmatically instantiated by the Oedipus Tyrannus. The Longest Journey begins with a memorable assertion. The cow is there. A group of Cambridge undergraduates is engaged in philosophical disputation on the existence of objects. Do they exist only when there is someone to look at them, or have they a real existence of their own? The notion of reality, as has often been remarked, lies close to the core of this work. Though early in the novel he denies it, Ricky Elliott is an idealist who has extreme difficulty in seeing things as they are. A budding writer, his stories tell of dryads, and he can't get them published. Lack of success here is mirrored in his personal life, or rather, apparent success in this arena turns out to be failure. Ricky marries a woman he's known since childhood, Agnes Pembroke, convinced that they love each other, but he misperceives her. And the marriage, for the sake of which Ricky is induced to lay aside his writing ambitions in order to become a master at an intellectually and spiritually crippling public school, becomes a shell. His best friend at Cambridge, Stuart Ansell, sees through Agnes early, almost literally, indeed. When she first appears in Ricky's rooms on the occasion of the discussion about the cow, long before their engagement, he attempts to introduce Ansell to Agnes. But we're told, "There came an awful moment, a moment when he almost regretted that he had a clever friend. Ansell remained absolutely motionless, moving neither hand nor head." Such behaviour is so unknown that Miss Pembroke did not realise what had happened and kept her own hand stretched out longer than is maidenly. When Ricky later upbraids Ansell for his rudeness to his guest, Ansell claims not to know who is meant. Miss Pembroke, whom you saw? I saw no one. Who came in? No one came in. You're an ass, shrieked Ricky. She came in. You saw her come in. She and her brother have been to dinner. You only think so. They were not really there. Ansel, who had been the one to assert that the cow was there, whether he himself was in Cambridge or Iceland or dead, is not, as Ricky first thinks, playing a game. He's switching from an epistemological understanding of the notion of reality, where the influence is essentially that of the philosopher G. E. Moore, to an ethical one. It's in an ethical sense that Ansel regards Agnes as not really there. He detects that she has no substance. As he subsequently tells Ricky, she is neither serious nor truthful. This gives you some idea of the kinds of concern with reality that inform the novel, but the aspect on which I want to focus is the world of illusion from which Ricky finds it so hard to escape. Here, in general terms, we feel the distant rumble of the OT, a play, of course, much concerned with the theme of appearance and reality, illusion and truth. Oedipus, who appears at the beginning to be a great king, adored by his people, rated close to a god, turns out, by the end, to be, in his own words, or Jeb's, the mortal most abhorred of heaven, who has lost everything. And this confusion and paradox can be seen in a whole range of respects. Oedipus, the stranger from Corinth who has come to Thebes, turns out to be Theban-born. Oedipus, the saviour of the city, solver of riddles, turns out to be the bringer of plague on the city, incapable of solving Tiresias' riddles about himself. Or, rather differently, let's recall that when the Corinthian messenger arrives, he seems to bring good news that Polybus of Corinth is dead and Oedipus has avoided killing his father, but in fact, his arrival opens the way for Oedipus to be revealed not only as Laius' murderer, but as the murderer of his father and husband of his mother. In The Longest Journey, we are in a quite different world, the bourgeois and cloying domestic world of Edwardian or late Victorian England. But the difference in setting and tone should not obscure this broad thematic similarity, or the fact that the novel too is, untypically of Forster, tragic in character. At the end, Ricky is killed in a railway accident, having learned, like Oedipus, many painful truths, and facing, had he lived, a return to a life of a kind that might make death seem desirable. If, however, we narrow the focus, we can see more specific points of connection between the two texts. Much of the illusion which surrounds Ricky has to do with his relationships with two women. One is Agnes, who is not the woman he first believes she is. When he responds to a letter from Ansel urging him to break off the engagement, he represents her as a woman who will not cut him off from other essential needs, as Ansel is sure she will. She wants me to have them, friends and work and spiritual freedom and everything. But Ansel is right. The marriage traps Ricky in a life of tedium and convention at Sawston School and sucks the breath out of him. The other woman is, of course, Ricky's mother, who had died suddenly when he was 15, 11 days after the death of his father. He idealises her, and like Agnes, she is not who she seems to be. In the course of the novel, Ricky discovers that he has a half-brother, Stephen, a man unlike himself in all respects, physically strong, unintellectual, crude, a hard drinker. The discovery shocks him, and under Agnes' influence, he rejects Stephen, the product of his hated father's sin. Only later does he learn, in a wonderful moment of anagnorisis, that Stephen is not, in fact, the illegitimate son of his father, but of his mother. Neither Ricky's wife nor his mother turns out to be whom he believes her to be. Equally, but with greater complexity and irony, of course, Oedipus' wife turns out to be his mother, while the woman he believes to be his mother turns out to be nothing of the kind. In a conversation with Ansel about friendship shortly before going down from Cambridge, a time when the futures of friendships are in doubt, Ricky says, "I wish we were labelled so as to ensure recognition in time to come." Rather Euripidean notion, it seems to me. The labelling of Agnes and of Stephen would have been of great use to Ricky, just as Oedipus could, we may think, have avoided his fate if similar labels had been worn by his true and his adoptive parents, though Forster's novel also argues strongly against the recognition of individuals by their labels rather than by their human reality. Ricky should accept and love Stephen not because he is his mother's son, but because he is who, not what, he is. Ricky's initial assumption that Stephen is his paternal half-brother arises itself from a very Oedipidean error. Oedipus cannot or will not see the truth, though it is before his very eyes. His belief that Polybus and Merope are his true parents leads him never to reflect, as we may suppose, that in killing the stranger at the Three Ways and marrying Jocasta, he has in fact fulfilled the oracle. Even when, in the play, Tiresias tells him, allusively but plainly enough, what he has done, he fails to grasp the prophet's meaning. Just so, the evidence that the healthy Stephen is his mother's, not his father's, child accompanies Ricky with every step he takes, for his lameness is inherited, as he well knows, through his father's line. Ricky's idealization of his mother and hatred of his father blind him to the obvious truth. In leaping to false conclusions, he also resembles Oedipus, whose reaction to what he's told by the prophet is to accuse him and Creon, wholly unreasonably, of plotting against him. Ricky's blindness takes us back to the scene of the attempted introduction of Ansel and Agnes. Ansel sees nothing, no one, but actually sees everything. He is, in his seeing and his prophetic warning, "I foresee the most appalling catastrophe," the Tiresias to match Ricky's Oedipus. The idea of blindness is also apparent in the novel which Forster published the next year, 1908, A Room with a View. As the title suggests, this work is much concerned with seeing. In one way, it's an inside-out version of The Longest Journey. An unhappy, unsuitable marriage is avoided and love attained. For most of the story, the young woman at its centre, Lucy Honeychurch, denies her feelings for the passionate, unconventional George Emerson, whom she'd met on holiday in Italy and who had tried, when he should not have tried, seizing her for a kiss, and chooses instead the socially appropriate, desiccated aesthete Cecil Vyse, one of those chaps who are no good for anything but books. Cecil does not see the world around him because he goes about with his nose in a book and assimilates all life to art, regarding Lucy like a painting, something to possess, not a living woman. When finally she realises this, breaks off the engagement and tells Cecil what he is, it is, in his own words, a revelation. Lucy, in accordance with her name, sheds light, enabling Cecil to see the truth about himself. Cecil, in whose first name is inscribed the idea of blindness, and in whose surname, Vyse, the idea of a mask before his face, a visor. But it's another Oedipidean theme which shapes the action, both in A Room with a View and in Howards End, which appeared in 1910. Often described as a tragedy of fate, the OT, as everybody here will know, could more precisely be said to offer an exploration of predetermination, foreknowledge, coincidence, and choice, and the relationship between them as possible factors directing the course of the individual human life. The working out of Oedipus' fate, as we see it in Sophocles' play, involves a combination of characteristic action on Oedipus' part and coincidence. The First and essential coincidence in the story is that Oedipus and Laius should be travelling on the same road at the same time and should meet. This event, of course, lies outside the drama, but coincidence recurs, importantly, in the play itself. When it seems that Oedipus might indeed be the murderer of Laius, but has, as yet, beyond what Tiresias has had said, no ground for believing that Laius was his father, the Corinthian messenger arrives with the news of the death of Polybus. The joy of Oedipus and Jocasta at this apparent refutation of the oracle is short-lived, for the messenger informs them that Polybus and Merope were not Oedipus' parents, as he, the messenger, knows, because he was the shepherd who received the infant with the pierced feet on Mount Kithairon all those years before. Equally coincidental is the fact that the Theban herdsman, from whom the Corinthian messenger had received the exposed child, should be the man who has already been sent for by Oedipus as the sole witness to Laius' murder, and who, when he arrives, sets in place the last awful pieces of the jigsaw. In talking here of Oedipus' fate, I've taken the view that it includes not only the parricide and incest, but also his discovery of the facts. For although in the play the personal characteristics of Oedipus clearly perform an important part in the revelation, his concern for plague-stricken Thebes, which drives his search for Laius' murderer, his ruthless will to know, we are, I think, encouraged to regard it as intended that he should find out. 'Tis, after all, Apollo who commands that Laius' killer be found, and while the identification of Oedipus as this man need not in itself establish him also as the son of Laius and Jocasta, the command initiates the whole process of inquiry, and the coincidences which follow as the search takes its course tend to the same conclusion. The presence in the story of two stages in the rescue of the child abandoned on Kithairon and the reappearance of both the Theban and the Corinthian herdsman years later, one of them in an entirely different capacity, all of which is commonly attributed to Sophoclean innovation, is explicable in purely dramatic terms, but it also serves to give a special prominence to the idea of coincidence and its role in the life of Oedipus, a point which I think is often overlooked. The meeting of any two people can naturally be attributed to chance, the absence of meaning. And in the ordinary way of things, nothing need be made of the meeting of George Emerson and Lucy Honeychurch in a guest house in Florence. But their witnessing of a lethal stabbing in the Piazza Signoria, where George catches Lucy in his arms as she faints, changes things in some mysterious way. As Lucy sits, recovering herself, the narrator says, again, the thought occurred to her, oh, what have I done? The thought that she, as well as the dying man, had crossed some spiritual boundary. George, in turn, becomes aware that something tremendous has happened and means to find out what it is. Their progress, though, is derailed by the kiss, which, though Lucy desires it, drives her, under the influence of her upright companion, Miss Bartlett, away from Florence to Rome, where, with bitter irony, her relationship with Cecil begins to develop. In the narrator's words, George and Lucy, standing on a bridge over the Arno after the murder, had come to a situation where childhood enters upon the branching paths of youth. At Rome, Lucy enters on a branch which seems to take her away from George, but a nexus of coincidence brings him back to her by a circuitous route. Sir Harry Otway, a neighbour of the Honeychurches in Surrey, has a cottage to let. One day in the National Gallery, where else, Cecil meets a father and son, and in conversation discovers that they're looking for exactly this sort of place, out of amused malice, for Sir Harry won't much care for these men of an inferior social class. Cecil arranges their tenancy. They turn out, of course, to be the very Emersons, George and his father, whom Lucy had met in Florence. On their arrival in the village of Summer Street, the Emersons receive a visit from the rector, Mr. Beebe, who had also, by chance, been staying in the same Florentine guest house at the time of the incident involving Lucy and George. Accompanying him is Lucy's brother, Freddy, who immediately suggests that George go for a bathe with him in a pond in a local wood. As they walk there, as you do, as they walk there with Mr. Beebe, the clergyman remarks on the coincidence of the Emersons meeting Cecil, which has reunited them with their acquaintances from Italy. And this is passage one on the handout. I'm going to read it. "And what a coincidence that you should meet Mr. Vyse. Did you realise that you would find all the Pension Bertolini down here?" "I did not. Miss Lavish told me." "When I was a young man, I always meant to write a history of coincidence." No enthusiasm. "Though, as a matter of fact, coincidences are much rarer than we suppose. For example, it isn't pure coincidentality that you're here now, when one comes to reflect." To his relief, George began to talk. "It is. I have reflected. It is fate. Everything is fate. We are flung together by fate, drawn apart by fate, flung together, drawn apart. The 12 winds blow us. We settle nothing." "You have not reflected at all," rapped the clergyman. "Let me give you a useful tip, Emerson. Attribute nothing to fate. Don't say, 'I didn't do this,' for you did it, 10-1. Now I'll cross-question you. Where did you first meet Miss Honeychurch and myself?"
"Italy."
"And where did you meet Mr. Vyse, who is going to marry Miss Honeychurch?"
"National Gallery."
"Looking at Italian art. There you are. And yet you talk of coincidence and fate. You naturally seek out things Italian, and so do we and our friends. This narrows the field immeasurably, and we meet again in it."
"It is fate that I am here," persisted George. "But you can call it Italy if it makes you less unhappy."
Coincidence and fate. We might, of course, prefer Mr. Beebe's version of what has happened to George's, and neither is narratorially authorised, but we are at the very least presented explicitly with the idea that George's coming to Summer Street is somehow an act of external design. When Freddy subsequently invites George to the Honeychurch home for tennis, and he and Lucy meet again, a further coincidence brings to life and puts them fully in mind of the kiss they shared in the hills above the Arno Valley. Cecil, inevitably, has a book. A bad novel. A love story set in Florence by one Joseph Emery Prank. When he begins to describe it, Lucy immediately recognises it as the work of Eleanor Lavish, another of the guests from the Bertolini. Cecil proceeds to read aloud to George and Lucy a passage he finds ridiculous. And it is Miss Lavish's recreation of the kiss. Here, the narratorial voice does hint at the notion of design in which the romantic novelist is in some way involved. Miss Lavish knew somehow, and had printed the past in draggled prose for Cecil to read and for George to hear. In that awful moment of embarrassed realisation, Lucy turns away from Cecil. Lest Cecil should see her face, she turned to George, and she saw his face. When, immediately afterwards, they get up to go inside for tea, Cecil leaves the book behind and has to go back for it, and George seizes Lucy for a second kiss. The suggestions of an inevitable future for Lucy and George, of something fated, are underlined, at the end of the novel, which concludes as it began in the Pension Bertolini, but this time the couple are married. And yet even here, the difficulty of interpreting events is acknowledged. The narrator says of George, as he looks back, "Ever prone to magnify fate, George counted up the forces that had swept him into this contentment." Should we take magnify to mean extol, or to mean exaggerate? Was the outcome inevitable?
For that matter, might Oedipus' discovery of the truth have been the result of chance, meaningless coincidence, after all? Though much more complex than that of A Room with a View, the plot of Howard's End is also shot through with the threads of fate. This is a novel concerning a house and three families. Margaret and Helen Schlegel are sisters of wide cultural interests and marriageable age, who live in London with their younger brother Tibby. Into their orbit come, on the one hand, the Wilcox family, whose head, Henry, a man of mature years, has made them wealthy through commerce, and on the other, Leonard Bast, a young and poor clerk, and his wife, Jackie. Margaret Schlegel befriends Henry Wilcox's wife, Ruth, a woman devoted to Howard's End, the house in the country in which she was born and which is her own, not her husband's property. When she learns that Margaret and her siblings will have to leave Wickham Place, their London home, in which they too have lived all their lives, when the lease expires, she is outraged, passionately hurt on their behalf. On an apparent whim, she asks Margaret to accompany her to Howard's End there and then. Margaret declines and leaves, then changes her mind and rushes in a cab to King's Cross to catch Mrs. Wilcox at the start of her journey, convinced, as the narrator tells us, that the escapade was important, though it would have puzzled her to say why. For reasons I needn't go into here, Margaret does not finally go to Howard's End on that occasion, and soon after, Ruth Wilcox, who has been ill, dies. And then something remarkable happens. Henry Wilcox receives from the nursing home a note addressed to him, unsigned, but written by his wife in her last illness, saying, "I should like Miss Schlegel, Margaret, to have Howard's End." The Wilcox family is horrified, and judging Mrs. Wilcox to have been influenced by her state of health, they resolve to burn the note. The narrator is sympathetic. To them, Howard's End was a house. They could not know that to her it had been a spirit for which she sought a spiritual heir. The route by which Margaret comes into her rightful inheritance is strange and tangled. 2 years pass. A casual social connection with Henry Wilcox is maintained, and one day, Henry asks Margaret to marry him. She agrees, and at last she gets to see Howard's End, empty, for the tenant to whom Henry had let it has left. As she looks around the house alone, she hears a noise. The house reverberates. And this is passage 2 on the handout. "Is that you, Henry?" she called. There was no answer, but the house reverberated again. "Henry, have you got in?" But it was the heart of the house beating, faintly at first, then loudly, martially. It dominated the rain. It's the starved imagination, not the well-nourished, that is afraid. Margaret flung open the door to the stairs. A noise as of drums seemed to deafen her. A woman, an old woman, was descending, with figure erect, with face impassive, with lips that parted and said dryly, "Oh, well, I took you for Ruth Wilcox." Margaret stammered, Mrs. Wilcox. In fancy, of course, in fancy, you had her way of walking. Good day. And the old woman passed out into the rain. The old woman is Miss Avery, the housekeeper, and what she says here strengthens the connection already made between Margaret and Ruth Wilcox. They seem in some sense to be identified. In due course, Henry agrees to allow the Schlegels to store the furniture from Wickham Place in Howard's End. A permanent new home for Helen and Tibby has not been found, but as she has taken off to Germany and Tibby is at Oxford, the pressure is for the moment off. The furniture is not meant to be unpacked, but Miss Avery takes it upon herself to unpack it. And, says the narrator, with focalization through Margaret, the furniture in the dining room fitted extraordinarily well. This idea recurs later in a scene where Helen, newly returned from Germany and pregnant, sees, together with Margaret, the hall furnished with the contents of the Wickham Place library. Striking here is Margaret's observation. Curious, too, that the carpet fits. Helen objects that the carpet is a mistake, the floor's far too beautiful, but it fits, and we're encouraged to think that the carpet and the family sword, which Miss Avery has hung among the bookshelves, where, the sisters agree, it looks magnificent, belong in this room in Howards End. And Margaret seems to belong here as well. Miss Avery's near identification of her with Ruth Wilcox is followed later by the scene in which Margaret discovers that the house has been furnished with her possessions, and her denial that she's going to live there is met by Miss Avery with the retort, "You think that you won't come back to live here, Mrs. Wilcox, but you will." Miss Avery knows, somehow, that Margaret Schlegel is meant to be at Howards End. And finally, not only does she come to live there, but her husband, Henry Wilcox, leaves her the property in his will. "Then I leave Howards End to my wife, absolutely," said Henry, "and let everyone understand that, and after I'm dead, let there be no jealousy and no surprise." Margaret did not answer. There was something uncanny in her triumph. "It does seem curious," says Dolly, Henry Wilcox's daughter-in-law, here on almost the last page of the novel, "that Mrs. Wilcox should have left Margaret Howards End and she get it after all." It is, it seems, Margaret's destiny to live at Howards End and possess it. And once again, the fulfilment of destiny is intimately connected with coincidence. The decision Henry Wilcox makes to leave Howards End to Margaret follows the death in the house of Leonard Bast at the hands of Henry's son Charles. It is Leonard who is the father of Helen's unborn child, a consequence of a single unplanned sexual act in the aftermath of a scene of painful emotion in which it is revealed that Leonard's Jackie and Henry were once lovers. They've had no contact for years and meet again only through the link with the Schlegels. Leonard's association with the Schlegels itself is the result of coincidence. When Helen accidentally takes his umbrella as she departs from a concert, his fatal, forgotten umbrella, as Catherine Mansfield was to refer to it. The calling card given to him by Margaret following this incident, described by the narrator himself as the fatal card, similarly possesses an instrumental function in the working out of the action. When Charles kills Leonard, he is seeking to punish him for, as he sees it, dishonouring Helen. It's quite coincidental that Leonard should appear after a long absence at Howards End, just as Charles himself happens to be there. The killing is not deliberate, but it is the indirect result of Charles beating Leonard with a flat blade of the sword which suited the room so well. And Charles goes to prison for manslaughter. The house is made over to Margaret, partly at least, because Charles will be unable to live there again. And to that extent, the Schlegel family sword, taken into the wrong hands, is instrumental in acquiring for Margaret the home in which she and it rightly belong. "I'm no fatalist," says Henry Wilcox at one point to Helen. "Heaven forbid! But our civilization is moulded by great impersonal forces." For Henry, the very embodiment of capitalism, these forces are simply economic. There always have been rich and poor, and there always will be rich and poor. But he is, it seems, ironically right in perceiving the existence of some inscrutable imperative, which, in Howards End, as in A Room with a View, we're encouraged to regard as bringing about an inevitable end through the operation of what at first seems to be no more than coincidence. Coincidence, then, in these novels of Forster, is not simply the kind of improbable narrative device familiar in so many 19th century novels, Jane Eyre's rich uncle in Madeira. It is meaningfully woven into the thematic texture of the work. This is the world of Oedipus. Forster, then, is perhaps more of a tragic writer than he's typically given credit for, and indeed, if one looks carefully, one will find a surprising amount of reference to tragedy and the tragic in his fiction. Yet even in The Longest Journey, he is patently not tragic as, to draw an obvious comparison, Hardy is tragic. And as I've tried to show, in Howards End, and especially A Room with a View, Forster redirects the Sophoclean entangling of coincidence and fate towards a positive outcome. Fate here is providential. But I'd like to end with some brief reflections on what I've been engaged in this afternoon, if only for purposes of provocation. My essential argument has been constructed in such a way as to suggest that these three novels of Forster were thematically influenced by the Oedipus Tyrannus. But I don't wish it to be thought that the argument hangs on the assumption that Forster was closely familiar with the OT, though I think it in the highest degree improbable that he was not. So let us, in conclusion, put aside the question of influence altogether, in a kind of homage to Forster, who in aspects of the novel envisages the English novelists not as floating down that stream which bears all its sons away, unless they are careful, but as seated together in a room, a circular room, a sort of British Museum reading room, all writing their novels simultaneously. Let us accept that the OT and Forster's novels belong as much to our world as to their respective contexts of production, that they contribute to forming the present, and thus, from the point of view of the contemporary reader, possess an equivalence. Within this perspective, what I've been doing could be described as viewing Forster through the lens of the OT, treating the play as a heuristic tool. And should anyone of more positivist inclinations object to such an interpretative strategy, I will reply that as artifacts that coexist in the present, these texts offer themselves to association by critics. And that if our understanding of any particular text, which will almost inevitably be informed by the accumulation of interpretations rolled up in that text, enables us to perceive in a second text something we had not seen in it before, and our insight carries conviction for others, then we will have managed to achieve in a small way something on which E.M. Forster set such value. Connection. Thank you very much.